everything that business consultants have, the advice that they've given to their clients for two decades now has been, the future is in China. You know, it's just like a given. And now we're all sort of standing around saying, well, maybe the future is not China, and maybe we're just going to stop trading as much as we used to.
This is Inside Asia, and I'm Steve Stein. My guest this episode is none other than Clay Chandler, Executive Editor International for Time Inc., as well as Asia Editor for Fortune. Those of you listening who are true Asia insiders will also perhaps recognize him as the writer of the special Sino-Saturday edition of Alan Murray's influential Fortune CEO Daily Newsletter. If you haven't subscribed to the newsletter, my advice is to do so immediately. It's exceptional weekly insights from top news veterans. Let's get to our discussion. I start off by asking Clay about deteriorating U.S.-China trade relations and how Chinese companies might be impacted.
For us, as we go around and talk to executives at Fortune 500 companies, there are a handful of things that everybody struggles with. And one of the big topics for everyone is, how do you run global companies in an anti-global age, which increasingly, clearly, that's, you know, the world we live in. And it's a complicated challenge, because although globalization and globalism is now out of fashion as an idea, it is not out of order as an organizing principle for businesses. You can still run a very successful company by having a global strategy, and it's very difficult to get a large company in the modern world if you don't have a global strategy. Just being a regional player, you leave yourself vulnerable to disruption by somebody who has a global strategy. So you have to stay global to succeed, and yet your stakeholders are much less enamored with that idea than they were even 5 years ago.
And what an interesting time for a Chinese company is coming into their own, and all of a sudden, just as they're about to go global, whether it's the Alibabas, Baidus, Tencents of the world, all of a sudden there's this kind of foot on the back of the neck saying, you know what, the world's changed its mind, we might not want that to happen. And then what do? How do you pivot?
Right. Well, yeah, it's fascinating. And so the executives that we deal with and speak to in China are dealing with the opposite end of this question, which is that now is their moment to take their place on the global stage. And yet there's a hostility and a resistance to them now that was not here, you know, only a few years ago. I mean, I think, for example, of the famous line that's attributed to Jack Ma when he was fighting against eBay, and everyone said, "Oh, you'll never be able to beat a giant tech from company from the United States in your own market once they've decided to move in." And Jack famously said, "Well, we will. They may be the shark, you know, from the deep blue ocean, but we're the crocodile of the Yangtze, and in our murky home waters, we will triumph." Well, so now Alibaba is so big, right? It has to go out and sail and swim in the open waters, right? And can Alibaba succeed out in the open ocean? Not very clear.
Yeah, and there's two questions on that. One is the cultural capabilities of some of these companies, because, and we can talk about some of the experiences in Southeast Asia, U.S., elsewhere. There's also the political implications.
Right.
You know, the fact in the U.S. that lots of Chinese companies are being held back by U.S. government impositions, which rejecting their products or their services in those markets.
Right.
So let's talk first about some of the, you know, the capital constraints, what's happening within China's government system, and how that's forcing a lot of Chinese companies to rethink their plans.
Yeah, I think that's an important dynamic. And I would say in some ways it's even more complicated than that, because the world is really now kind of cleaving into two parallel but very separate technoblocks in a way. I mean, it's not just that there are restrictions on the movement of people, increasingly on goods going back and forth across border. Increasingly now we're seeing governments trying to get into the business of restricting data from flowing across border, and that we even use different operating systems. I mean, if you think about what's emerged in China, you know, if you get off the plane and in Beijing and think that you can use the whole kind of scramble of apps that are sitting on your iPhone and live a normal functional life in China, forget about it.
You can't. A lot of people don't know that. I mean, you can't get on Facebook.
That's
you
right.
can't search with Google. I mean, you name it. There's probably about 15, 20 different U.S.-based or global services that simply are not available in China.
That's right. And the Chinese are all using, you know, they're using WeChat. They're using Alipay. They're using all these different things that we don't even know about in the West. And it's not just that. So even if you were a perfectly fluent Mandarin speaker and you got off the plane, you would still be, you know, befuddled by this different operating system. And it's not just that, you know, they're different brands with different logos. They work in different ways. They interact with each other in different ways. You have to be set up differently, and society has organized itself differently around these technologies. So, you know, in China, people spend hours on WeChat. They live on it. Yeah. They do everything, whether it's order their food, order their taxi, you know, chat with their friends, search the news. It's kind of the one app to rule them all. And that's a bit of an alien concept for us.
But it is so sophisticated in so many ways. In fact, well beyond anything that exists in Europe and the U.S. And some people were arguing that actually was a method or a tactic used by China to protect and allow those companies to grow and develop without foreign competition. They had to compete among themselves, too. It's not like they had a free ride the whole way up.
Right.
But now going global, because they're so different, as you're rightly pointing out, that the whole structure and organization is so different, how are they going to compete in those global markets where people have grown accustomed to other type of applications or capabilities?
Well, they're bumping up against government regulation, number one. They're bumping up against legacy, you know, established players in these home markets, number two. And then there's just a tremendous amount of kind of social and cultural inertia. You know, we're used to being on Facebook. So that may seem slow and pokey and pointless to Chinese who are used to, you know, the how fast and convenient everything is on their social media apps. But it's hard to get people to unstick from their established habits. I think for younger kids, they're definitely figuring this stuff out. I was very interested to see, I happened to go to the premiere of Crazy Rich Asians. Yeah. In Singapore, and some of the cast was there, and it was just a lot of fun. But there's that opening scene in Crazy Rich Asians where the two protagonists kind of decide that they're going to go on this vacation to Singapore, and they're spotted by someone sitting in a cafe in Brooklyn or something like that, who realizes, oh, wow, he's going out with this girl. This is going to be a great scandal back home. And she, you know, takes a photograph and then sends it spiraling out across the Pacific Ocean, and it gets spread over social media. And it was really hard to kind of represent that in film. They use these little kind of swirling, you know, icons for the different social media channels. But I thought that they didn't quite get it right, because the overseas Chinese use a completely different set of apps, social media apps, than the ones that are behind the Great Firewall, right? So, they had WeChat, and they had Facebook, and they had, you know, Instagram and everything else. But if you look at the numbers, actually, the Chinese that are in Taiwan, the Chinese that are in Malaysia and Singapore, even in Hong Kong, they don't really use WeChat, right? So they're part of this world beyond the wall, and trying to communicate with very different stuff inside the wall. In some ways, I thought the movie was might have been better named, you know, Crazy Rich Overseas Chinese, because it's a fine gradation.
So let's talk about data a little bit, because that's a really great example. I remember 15, 20 years ago when, you know, the firewalls were being thrown up in China and saying, well, we are going to restrict data flow and we're going to do it on our terms. Everyone kind of scoffed and said, hey, you can't do that. It's data. That's a global, it's a universal thing. Well, damned if they didn't, right? And they pulled it off. Is that simply because they've got the numbers to do it?
It's so incredible. I remember I was working for the Washington Post when there was this big push to get China into the WTO. I remember Clinton giving these kind of impassioned speeches. He made the famous one where he said, yeah, okay, they censor the internet, but that's no reason to keep them out of the WTO because they're on the wrong side of history. And trying to, censor the internet is like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. Well, guess what? They're pretty damn good at nailing Jell-O.
Yeah, solid Jell-O.
That's right. Yeah. And part of the reason for that is that they have collaborated with Western companies that sold them the technology that they needed to be able to do that. And part of the reason for that is that they're able to mobilize huge numbers of people to be engaged in censorship. That would be unthinkable in an open democratic society. But it is extraordinary to me the degree to which they have succeeded in discouraging people from getting access to data and information that they don't want them to see.
Well, I guess they just because they kept things so damn interesting, right? The applications, the capabilities, the access to content. I mean, it's just wildly. I mean, just to go and experiment with that. And my Chinese isn't perfect, but I could play around a lot. And I'm just overwhelmed at how many options and opportunity almost kind of blinds you to the idea that anything exists outside of China if you are Chinese.
Right. Yeah. That's right. I mean, ordinary Chinese are not really looking for news about human rights or what's going on in Tibet or any of these other subjects that are kind of off limits inside the firewall. But they're interested in a lot of the same sorts of things that we're interested in. Pop stars, sports competitions, fashion styles, themselves.
So they've succeeded against all expectations, just like China itself not being, a free market democracy. People said it won't be able to thrive in a capitalist environment. Well, they proved us wrong on that too, didn't they?
Yeah. And what's really astonishing about China is that I think we haven't really even begun to imagine how far this can run, because the thing about China, the basic insight is it's a big country. And so they can take all these technologies and they can scale them to levels that we can't even contemplate in the U.S. I mean, think about it. 800 million smartphone users in China. That's triple the population of the entire United States. And they're using those smartphones a much larger percentage of their day than we are. And all the data that's generated by those phones, there's more of it because Chinese have a far more digitally integrated life than we do. They use those phones to make purchases. They use them to hail a taxi, to ride a bicycle, to do all manner of things. And so that data then is now aggregated. And I think this is actually quite important. We always worry about the concentration of the fangs in the U.S. But basically,
tell them the fangs.
The Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. But in China, they're basically two big technology groups. Maybe two and a half if you add Baidu. But Alibaba and Tencent have got investments and people into virtually all the important data absorbing. Companies that really matter, whether it's Ofo or whether it's Mobike or whether it's Meituan or whether whatever it is, so Chinese are just kind of used to surrendering all this data if it's convenient, because it's just a different cultural attitude.
And there's not the concerns about privacy that they have in the West. In fact, it's a communist country, and frankly, privacy is not your mandate or remit, right?
That's right.
So therefore, we're fine to give it over, and if it feeds us more insights and information or creates buying behaviors that allow us to get what we want faster, we're good with that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so when you sort of start working through some of the implications of this, they're amazing and possibly very troubling. I mean, Kai-Fu Lee's got this wonderful, fascinating new book, AI Superpowers.
The former head of Microsoft and Google.
Former head of Microsoft and really has been involved in a lot of the original research on AI. And one of the ideas that's sort of buried in this book that I think is really fascinating is this notion that, you'll have AI superpowers in every sense of the world. In other words, that the world will be forced to, the other countries in the world will be forced to become kind of client states of these two giant AI superpowers. Because his argument is that we have come through this age of discovery when it comes to AI and data, where brilliant breakthroughs of geniuses really made all the differences in the advances of technology. So we're now in this different age. We're shifting to an age of implementation, where you don't need genius AI scientists. Really, all you need is a bunch of really kind of competent, basically okay engineers to roll this stuff out across vast scale. And China has lots of those basically competent engineers. And so he says, when you start scaling stuff, the advantages are all in how much data you can grind to make breakthroughs in deep learning and machine learning. And it's not genius, sort of breakthrough insights. And in that world, China has all the advantages, because there's just so much more data per capita and in absolute terms there than we're capable of generating in the United States. And certainly, Europe has nowhere near that capability.
This is Inside Asia, and my guest is Clay Chandler, Fortune's Asia editor. More in a moment. I'm Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. My guest this episode is one of the most acute Asia insiders around, Clay Chandler. He's executive editor international for Time Inc. and Fortune, and weekly contributor to the special Sino-Saturday edition of the Fortune CEO Daily Newsletter. Let's get back to our conversation in the topic of artificial intelligence superpowers. It raises some interesting geopolitical questions, namely, should efforts be made to restrict China's access to overseas markets, or are we in a brave new world where data is fair game for anyone who can get their hands on it?
We're evolving into a very quid pro quo world where people say, okay, you won't let you won't let Google operate freely, you won't let Facebook operate freely. Guess what? We're going to do the same and restrict your companies as well. When you look at the sweep of the recent changes to FIRMA and the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., well, those are big changes. And I think they're already having a significant deterrent on investment behavior. We'll know more, I think, within the next couple of quarters how that plays out. But it looks like it's brought a lot of investments on both sides of the Pacific just grinding to a dead stop.
So in the U.S., are these politically motivated or commercially motivated? Are we looking to protect our corporations from, you know, viral competition from Chinese players? Or are we simply trying to make sure that the Chinese don't access our networks, our insights, our data, our personal data that might be then used for reasons that we're not comfortable with, paranoia or not? I mean, what would you say?
I think it's both. And I think we're all pretty well aware of the shift in political attitudes about China that we've seen over the last 5 years, and it's a bipartisan shift. The Democrats were just as eager to enact that new legislation as the Republicans, one of the few issues that they all agreed on. And so there's been a very decisive political shift from being, oh, let's engage with China, towards, wait a minute, China is a competitor, let's shut them out, let's create restrictions on our trade with them, even to the extent that I think there are a lot of people who now feel that even if it leaves us all worse off, if it hurts me individually, I don't care. Let's trade less with China. You know, I write these China newsletters for Fortune that go out on Saturdays, and the email that I get from them is really fascinating. And
the email you get from generally. Yeah.
I wrote something about China the other day that, you know, I kind of hinted that I thought that, a trade war can spiral out of control and it could end up coming back to haunt us in ways that, you know, we haven't anticipated yet and it was really risky.
Us being the U.S.
Yeah. And even if you thought it was a good idea and you thought that China deserved to have these tariffs imposed on them because they didn't play fair, that this could get out of control and it could come back to make us all regret that we went down this road. And I had a guy write back to me from a little kind of suburban town just outside of Boston. And he said, this is ridiculous. The Chinese are unfair. How can you say that? They've never played, you know, responsibly or fairly with us ever. Why should we do anything differently? And, this will help Americans' jobs and it'll be good for the American economy. And so I actually spent a couple of days engaging with him and sort of just trading emails with him. Why do you think that way? And what's your perspective? And what do you do for a living? So it turned out this guy was a builder, right? He was an independent contractor. And we asked him, well, how are you doing? And his business is actually doing pretty well. It's not that he's unemployed or out of a job. And in fact, he's having trouble finding the workers that he needed for his building business. And when you press him a little bit more about who his customers were, they're executives that work for big data and tech companies in Boston that are moving out of the city because real estate prices are a little bit too expensive. He's had a great business, though, in building these kind of McMansions for these people in the satellite areas of Boston. And I said, okay, well, tell me who these people's companies are. And when you hear the names of the companies right around every one of them, they're all companies that do tons of business in China that are making money off of China. So, you know, if you're that guy, you can have very anti-China attitudes, but you may not see necessarily the way that trade and cooperation with this big, scary, evil thing across the ocean is actually contributing to your livelihood.
Well, I don't think most people understand the complexity of trade. I mean, you know, just like in China, we throw up tariffs against Chinese-made products, but the Chinese are concerned about all the components that are coming from outside into the China manufacturing base place in order to get the products out. I mean, it's and people draw these straight, direct lines and think they've got it sorted, but that's not what's happening. It's very complex.
Yeah, it is. So, to me, what's very interesting, though, is that it's not just the shift in the popular attitude because these things are complex. That's kind of what you would anticipate. But we've now also had this very fundamental shift in the attitude of business people. And that's really big and a little bit frightening. So it's people that have been in China, that have been doing business in China for, you know, the 30 years since China opened up, are fed up. Yeah. And even though they get that this is a complex system, and even though they might get that their company now depends on China for a third of its revenue or whatever the number is, they're pissed off.
You know, Clay, though, it's so interesting. It's like the opium war in reverse, where the Brits used opium to control the Chinese for all those years. Like the Chinese have been using cheap-made Chinese products to control, sold through Walmart to control the American population right now. You get this feeling like it's a little bit of payback right now. Like they're not doing anything that we didn't do as an industrial giant. They're just doing it faster and better in some cases. And people don't like that because it's uncomfortable. But it's really, we won. They bought into capitalism. They're actually doing what we asked them to do. And now somehow they become this great global enemy. How do you, you know, reconcile that?
Well, the other lever that they have is not just that they make cheap stuff for Americans, is that they're this giant market that everybody knows that they have to get into because growth is slowing in other markets around the world. And this, for better or worse, is still a 6% plus economy, the second largest economy in the world, and still growing at the rate of an emerging economy. So if you're looking for ways to grow your business, you have to be here. And that's what's so amazing in a way about how this country that had no technology 20 years ago, that, you know, where Jack Ma, who we all sort of think of as this internet god, now, you know, at a fairly late stage of his life, 30-something years old, had never actually used the internet. I mean, you think about the implications of the story that he always tells, that, you know, he went to this friend's house in Seattle and typed in beer, and there was a machine that would then help him search for different brands of beer, and he couldn't find a beer from China, and like this light bulb went off in his head that this is how you start the business. I mean, that was not that long ago, right? And even those of us who have been going back and forth, to China regularly for a couple of decades now, we can just see how vast the changes are and how sophisticated this technology is. How has China managed to not just be completely colonized by these vastly more superior tech companies from Silicon Valley? The answer is they have been very, very clever at using the one thing that they had, which is their scale, their size, their market. Yeah. And they have used that as a kind of jujitsu to get us to give up all the other things that they needed. And they're now at a stage in their development where Xi Jinping can come and make this reprise of the Southern Tour, as he was last week in Guangzhou, and say, it's time for us to be independent. We don't have to rely on foreign technology anymore. We've got enough of a base that we can do it ourselves. And I think that's where we're headed now.
And as a result, I mean, Fortune has come up with a future Fortune 50.
Yeah.
And in that list of 50 companies, you're analyzing and looking at it based on future revenue potential and earnings potential.
Right.
And in there, 21 of the 50 are Chinese-based companies of all sorts, not just tech, but, you know, insurance, manufacturing, others, quite an interesting variety. It just speaks to the fact that whether we like it or not, Chinese companies have arrived, yeah, and now they're going to be, you know, looking for ways to compete in the world, if possible.
Yeah. I mean, even on our global Fortune 500 list, the presence of Chinese companies is, you know, it's huge. It gets bigger every year. I think it's 120 or something last year. I can't remember what the exact number is, but it's enormous. Mm-hmm. So, they're a fundamental part now of the global economy in a way that they were not just a decade ago.
So if, just back to the early part of the conversation, when you say we're now moving away from globalization to more kind of nationalism or domestic markets, in some ways that feeds right into China's greatest single strength, which is the fact that they're one of the largest populated countries in the world, and they haven't even started to trigger that right kind of domestic consumption drive.
Right. Yeah. And, I guess one question is the horizon that you're, you know, how far the horizon extends that you're looking at China for. Because a lot of people will argue that that in fact, you know, a lot of these development goals that China has set for whether it's robotics or AI or anything else are kind of in the 2025, 2030, 2050 kind of horizon. But demographers will tell you that the aging problem in Chinese democracy will start to really kick in a way that's quite painful in 2030. And so how does that then play out? I'm not sure that the Chinese have figured that out, even though they're a huge market. If they start going down the same road that Japan and South Korea, you know, are going down, are they going to be able to manage that as smoothly and effectively? I'm not sure. But, you know, it's fascinating to me. We, you know, to sort of use the Gwyneth Paltrow phrase, we're in this period where people are talking about conscious uncoupling, you know, that we have done, I mean, everything that business consultants have, the advice that they've given to their clients for two decades now has been, the future is in China. You know, it's just like a given. And now we're all sort of standing around saying, well, maybe the future is not China, and maybe we're just going to stop trading as much as we used to. Even if the supply chains don't migrate back to the United States, it's just we don't like dealing with them.
Yeah.
That seems to be what we're saying in the U.S. right now as a nation. And the question is, as the economic implications and consequences of that start to play out, I think it's actually possible that we'll still feel that way.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, we'd rather be poorer and interact with China less than be well off and figure out how to collaborate with them.
Do you think that's right? Generally across the United States, people would simply say, I am happy not to have a new car if it's coming out of China or something. We simply will – and that doesn't bode well for a capitalist economy, does it?
It doesn't. And it but I think it's a new thing. It's a new phenomenon. It used to be that people were, you know, apolitical when it came to, you know, their pocketbooks and what they spent their money on. And maybe that's true. But I think that there's this new kind of attitude that – I don't care if it's cheaper. I'm not buying it if it's not made in America.
Yeah.
Clay, thank you. Your versatility on China, the fact that you got Gwyneth Paltrow into a conversation on China is just astounding. So well done on that. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you.
This is Inside Asia. You've been listening to my conversation with Clay Chandler, longtime Asia watcher and executive editor international for Time Inc. and Asia editor for Fortune. At the end of each episode, I conclude with an Asia Insider Minute, where I try to sum things up, draw from the conversation you've just heard, and pose a few questions of my own. The discussion with Clay yields some key takeaways, not least of which is the digital discontinuity between East and West. Contrary to what many imagined would happen 10 or even 5 years ago concerning the efficacy of the Great Firewall, China has proven itself effective in limiting or entirely blocking market penetration of digital giants Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, best known by the acronym FANG. It was part of the bigger story we told ourselves about China opening up and engaging with the world. Digital had the power, so we believe, to eat away at the edges of communist ideology and make way for new modes of thinking. Ushering China into the global marketplace, we reasoned, would de facto pry open the doors to a borderless digital future where any attempt to block foreign participation would appear quaint, you know, kind of even retro-communist. Of course, none of this happened. As Clay points out, China moved to capitalize on its digital blockade, and in a two-decade frenzy of innovation and investment, created digital service alternatives not only better, but oftentimes superior to the Facebooks, Amazons, and Netflix of the world. This is the digital divide. A strain of Western arrogance runs through these assumptions. So proud are U.S. and European companies that they failed to peek past the Chinese firewall to witness a world of innovation and digital design in the making. There's a reason, Clay tells us, that the FANG digital giants from the West failed to conquer Chinese hearts and minds, and early exclusion from the China market is only part of the story. What China's entrepreneurs have built in the ensuing years is nothing to be trifled with. Even if China's 1 billion consumers could escape past the firewall to throw off their homegrown digital apps and services in exchange for Western alternatives, few would. Why, you ask? Because compared to the sublime design and integration of China's homegrown digital services like WeChat, Taobao, and Alipay, Facebook just isn't all that interesting. But there's a downside for China as well. By attaining such digital heights, the country may have set itself up for harder times. Clay talks of a potential pivot away from China as multinationals reassess the role the country plays in their global portfolios. If over the past quarter century, Asia generally and China specifically were seen as critical features of a global strategy, that may be about to change. Saber rattling by the Trump administration isn't making things any easier. Talk of a new Cold War makes investors and corporations uneasy, and even if it's mostly rhetoric, that can be enough to keep foreign direct investment in China at bay. Geopolitics appears to have the upper hand these days. It's stirring the pot of malcontent on all sides and throwing a spanner into the process of steely-eyed commercial logic. You don't have to listen to this podcast to know that people are increasingly inclined to think and act politically when it comes to protecting their own economic interests. The big question is whether we will still feel that way when the more severe economic implications start to kick in, trade beats a retreat, and the cost of goods start their precarious climb. How will global consumers feel about China then? What we have here is an emerging battle, not between China and the rest of the world, but rather a standoff between competing ideologies and economic self-interest. Which will prevail? Stay tuned. We'll let you know. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.